Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
And the countdown is on, about 1 month to go until school starts in the fall. But with the coronavirus pandemic still spiking across the country and a few troubling signs here in New England, what are school districts, parents, teachers, students to do? Massachusetts Commissioner of Education Jeff Riley is urging school districts to open in person in the fall. And so far, Somerville, Cambridge, and Boston made their September plans public. So listeners, we want to hear from you. What's your town planning? What would you like your town to plan? Are you concerned about the fall and the kids? Are you a student? What's your take? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we want to kick this off with WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Hello, Max.
Hi, Jamie.
So yesterday, Max, on the show, we heard from Boston City Councilor Kenzie Bock just as Boston Public Schools was putting out their draft plan. Now that we've had time to read it, what does it actually say?
Notably, Jamie, it does not say that there's going to be this prompt return of all 53,000 BPS students to classrooms. The report says either the district will begin fully remote, meaning students at home, or pursue a kind of hybrid model. In other words, students sharing space, coming in certain days of the week and learning partly online. And then beyond that, there's a good deal of uncertainty in this plan. The document we got was prominently labeled draft one, and I just want to give you a telling sentence for a kind of flavor of it. Students and staff will be back in our school buildings in some manner on some schedule at some point during the 2021 school year. And then in offering those two big options, namely remote or hybrid for the start of the year, BPS administrators are doing just what a large majority of surveyed BPS families told them they wanted. So you had two-thirds of respondents, including the vast majority of Black and Latino respondents, telling the district they wanted either online or a hybrid model this fall.
Got it. So, Max, I just should note that, you know, you're joining us remotely because so much of what WBUR is doing is from home. And there's so much uncertainty in what you're saying here, too, about the plan. What does it say that the state's largest public school system is so uncertain?
Well, I think that they just don't know what the fall is going to look like, right? You know, we haven't apparently tamed the virus, and even if we had, it could change quickly. We've got thousands of college students coming back to Greater Boston soon, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the implicit argument of this plan is that this is a whole community decision bound to be informed by what the mayor and governor decide and the recommendations of the city's public health officials. Tammy Poost, who's a senior advisor to BPS's superintendent, Brenda Caselius, she told reporters this morning that there just aren't really good options on offer right now, and that she asked for everyone's help as the plan takes shape.
Please give us your better ideas so that we can incorporate those in and make this plan better so that it's the best thing for this community when we get to the first day of school.
So I just want to note that's a real effort to reach out to the community, you know, where there are tons of different concerns, housing and health and food and work and disabilities. And that's something BPS hasn't always done. And yet, at the same time, I'm sure some people wanted a more concrete view of what's going to happen this fall.
So speaking of concrete views, do we have more clarity on what Somerville is announcing? We're going to hear in a moment from someone in Somerville, as well as Cambridge. What are they doing?
Yeah, in Somerville, they have taken that more concrete route. They said, we're just not going to open buildings for any student on the first day of school. You had city and district officials say they're just not yet confident in the ventilation systems in their buildings, and also that they want to get this virus tracking program up and running reliably before they reopen. I spoke to Rami Bridge, who's the president of the Somerville Teachers Association, the union there. He told me there's some relief among his educator members that there is a plan for the fall, even if it's not what they would have hoped for back in spring.
And, you know, in one of these meetings, one of the teachers said, you know, every day we don't make a decision, I'm a worse teacher in the fall. That, you know, people need time to plan, to figure out what the year is going to look like. Most educators didn't want to return to a remote model. They didn't want that, but there was a recognition of reality that that's likely where we're going to end up.
So meanwhile, you've got Cambridge's superintendent proposing a slightly more nuanced approach. Under that plan, students from grades 4 to 12 will stay home, Jamie, but then they'll plan to reopen buildings kind of on an individual basis, say for students with disabilities, as well as for younger kids mm-hmm. who might get a whole lot more out of being in a classroom and get a lot less out of online learning. And Cambridge's school committee will vote on that plan, I think, tomorrow night.
So I mentioned at the top there that Commissioner Riley was urging schools yesterday to get back in person. What's his argument? What's his case for that?
Yeah, Riley told this panel put on by the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce that he does still want in-person learning to happen as soon as possible. He was relying on the guidance of the American Academy of Pediatricians. And that group said in late June that schools ought to find a way to get kids physically back in schools because schools are, in effect, more than schools. We have, you know, almost 12 million children in America with limited access to food. They might get meals or snacks at school. Mm-hmm. Many others rely on schools for health or support in cases of disability. And then there's all this learning time that can easily be lost when teachers aren't laying eyes on kids directly. So Riley is still saying best is to go back in person, but I do think that's going to depend on the public health picture too, Jamie. If cases suddenly surged, then teachers and parents might start worrying so much that that advice might no longer seem practical or sensible.
So we're obviously waiting on a number of districts. When will we have every single town's plan? And what are you hearing about this decision by the commissioner to really have each city and town make their own choice?
Yeah, on the first part, there's a deadline here. DESE, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, of which Riley is in charge, they've asked for comprehensive plans to be submitted by August 10th. And I think that's this coming Monday, if I'm not mistaken. As for the local decision-making element here, obviously you do have the counterexample of California, where Governor Gavin Newsom created a pretty strict system that will limit how schools can physically reopen, how quickly last month. I think many teachers would love it if Governor Charlie Baker took a stronger line against physical reopening here. But then again, we have a pretty time-honored tradition of local decision-making on schools in Massachusetts. So I don't think it's extremely surprising that that's been the case on this issue as well. Obviously, that might look a lot worse in hindsight if schools became an apparent vector for the virus this fall.
So Max, you mentioned some of the many, many issues that face parents and teachers, administrators, students in the fall. We're going to take some calls here coming up. But how are schools that are having some in-person presence dealing with safety?
Yeah, something I hear again and again from teachers and administrators is that they want students and parents to understand that even if schools do physically reopen, this will not be a return to normalcy. The social distancing will start at the bus stop, and officials hope it will continue throughout the day. People will be spaced out. Students will be asked to wear masks or face shields in class. And then I think of the buildings, Jamie. When BPS did a survey of its physical plant a few years ago, dozens of schools scored moderate problems with their ventilation systems, and a dozen more needed the wholesale replacement of those systems. Dozens more had problems with their windows, which are supposed to remain open this fall, if that's possible. So I think there's going to be a lot of jerry-rigging and a lot of concern about the physical plant that students will be in this fall.
And as you said, that survey was long before the pandemic. WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, stand by. I want to take a couple of calls here. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. Jack is calling from Jamaica Plain. Jack, what's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm having some concerns as an after-school teacher. I've been an after-school educator for 10 years in Brookline, and my concerns more go to, if it is a hybrid model, how does that, you know, kind of play into the after-school programming that parents rely on for childcare? And then the kind of, as the safety model goes, is like, if I'm in a, we're using a kindergarten classroom, and they're in there all day, then the turnover, how do you go from the daytime to the after school in such a short time with a proper cleaning and ventilation system?
Are you worried about safety, Jack?
I am worried about safety. Yeah, I have a partner. You know, obviously it affects teachers and kids and families, but, you know, then my household, my partner has parents that she sees who are vulnerable. And so then it kind of, you know, is this going to make me not be able to see my family for the holiday? Am I going to be a liability?
Yeah. Thank you, Jack. Thanks for the call there. I also want to go to Donna. She's calling from Brockton. Donna, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I just wanted to point out the study that came out from South Korea, the large study that says that children under 10 don't spread the virus as much as children over 10. And maybe we can just concentrate like on a different plan for those kids to get them back to school sooner, just because they spread it less. And the other concern is in the school systems that have a lot of busing, that would also be another consideration to take into account. Like maybe parents can bring their kids to school versus like on the bus. But I have a stepson who's 4 years old in Boston, and it's very hard to teach him at home, and he does have a disability. So to get these younger kids in school with disabilities and things like that, I think we should prioritize them over the older kids.
Thank you, Donna. Yeah, those are the exact issues that we're talking about here, Max. And actually, I want to turn to someone who's grappling with these exact issues as we speak. Joining us on the line is the chair of the Somerville School Committee, Carrie Normand. Carrie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So I just want to get your initial thoughts and reactions to what we heard from Jack and Donna there. Those are real concerns that I understand they're folks outside of Somerville, but that I'm sure folks in Somerville are facing.
To say this is complex and unprecedented is an understatement. It is not just rethinking and looking at district-wide considerations of ventilation, but someone talked about buses. The minutiae of this cannot be overstated. So if a student is at the bus stop and we're going to take their temperature, is there someone at the bus stop taking the temperature of the student before they get on the bus? And if they have a fever, are they turned around? Who is where? I mean, there's so many decisions and so much procedural work that needs to be done to do this safely. And first and foremost, this is a health crisis, and safety is in Somerville, and I'm sure in every other district, the number one concern. It is insanely complex, and we are working hard to sort it out. But I'm a parent as well, parent and teachers concerned, students concerns too about going back. It's enormous, and yet we are all working towards how do you deliver the best education you can during a pandemic.
Well, listeners, the phone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How are you thinking about schooling in the fall? What are you worried about? What are your concerns? What do you think your city or town should be doing? Give us a ring. Carrie Normand from Somerville. So it is complex. At the same time, there is this concern about an entire lost generation of students.
Yes.
How do you counter, how do you balance those two things as a public official and, as you said, as a parent?
I wish I had the magic answer, right? Every decision, what we know is school kids learn best in person. We know our teachers want to be in schools with our students, and we know parents need to work. And we also need to consider the health concerns first and foremost of it. It's mind-boggling, and yet we need to move forward. So in Somerville, we are initially starting remote with planning and working towards a phased-in, in-person hybrid model. We will always have remote for our teachers and students who are unable or are uncomfortable coming back in person. But we need to also prioritize our younger students, who we know remote learning hasn't gone well for, the pre-K to second to third grade, our special education students, our English language learners, students in specialized programming. As we were able to open buildings and come back in a phased in, we will also need to prioritize our most vulnerable students and also have a more robust remote learning experience for all of our students.
So WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, I want to bring you back in here. What are we hearing about remote learning? We know that there have been challenges from March on through the end of the school year. So what are you seeing in your reporting about remote learning and how that will impact students in the fall?
Yeah, I think you got a little flavor of it in Rami Bridges' comments earlier, and certainly we've heard a little bit about it. It's nobody's idea of a good time, but I think the one thing that can really make remote learning a struggle is if you're learning how to do it on the fly, which certainly was the case in the spring. I think one of the virtues of the plan in Somerville is now you've told teachers with a month and more to prep that they will be doing this modality or paradigm, as it's sometimes called. And at least then you can craft your curriculum and programming to work in that way. That being said, I spoke to parents of students with disabilities and parents of really young kids. Remote learning is next to impossible in some of those families. And that's involved some really heroic adaptation on behalf of educators and families. So I think it will work better this fall, it seems to me, talking to some teachers, but it's imperfect, to be sure.
Got it. And Carrie Norman, chair of the Somerville School Committee, I do want to ask you, what happens if a student gets sick or a teacher gets sick or a whole class needs to be quarantined? I mean, are these the kind of things that Somerville is weighing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so in Somerville, the schools are working closely with our city health departments, our community partners. We're working closely with CHA, Community Health, Cambridge Health Alliance. We don't have yet exactly what those protocols will be. Those are all scenarios we need to, what happens if one student is sick? How do you keep the once you're in person, the smallest number of kids in a cohort so that if someone does test positive, it minimizes it. Going back to school, there is no perfect answer. The goal is to mitigate the risk as much as we possibly can and to be prepared. One of the reasons we're going remote initially is because we want to have all of those safety protocols, all of those health protocols in place beforehand, because these are inevitable situations that are going to arise. We're going to do everything we can not to, but we need to be prepared. I've been talking with a lot of parents, and a lot of the upside of COVID is these online school committee meetings. We had over 300 people, 90 people were able to do public comment on Monday night. And so there is a lot of listening and a lot of the community how to form these plans. But it is, you have to really take into every possible configuration. I mean, COVID is teaching us that our lives are wildly intertwined, in that the needs of each individual student and family is also unique. And so there isn't one plan that's going to answer all the questions. I keep saying we need to be prepared with the most resources and flexibility to be able to respond to however the virus, whatever form it takes, and whatever the needs are of our community, our teachers, and our students.
Well, that's Carrie Norman. She's chair of the Somerville School Committee. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I want to go back to the phones now. We've got Becky calling from Newton. Becky, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Thank you very much. I am a longtime middle school teacher in Newton. I'm also a parent in Newton. And I was talking to a few parents this morning just informally on the street, and people were talking about how much we want the hybrid model, thinking that full in-person is not even a possibility at this point, although the district hasn't made a formal announcement. But the thought of hybrid, meaning some kids go Monday, Tuesday, other kids go Thursday, Friday. And what I pointed out to the parents...
And then having Wednesday be a cleaning day or something?
Wouldn't Wednesday would be cleaning, right, I would assume cleaning at school and more remote learning at home.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know. I haven't been told. But what the parents didn't understand, which I pointed out, is that, in the spring, one of the largest challenges of teaching remotely, for me at least, I teach eighth grade, was that, it was hard for me to give the support that I wanted to give, both to general ed and to special ed students with the remote curriculum. So, you can put something online, and you can try to be as clear with the pedagogy as you can, but it doesn't mean that kids won't need support. Just like if they were in school and you presented something, then you go around and you support individually. So
yeah,
Doing that at school is difficult. My thought to the parents this morning was, when half of the cohort is at home and doing the remote assignment that we posted, and the other half is with me in the classroom, I am not physically able to support the kids doing the remote learning at home at all. So that will really be a shift for less support.
Yeah,
and I think that's something that a lot of parents aren't thinking about.
It's a real challenge, and thank you for the call, Becky. And I want to bring in another voice, someone who's dealing with this at a higher age group, right? We have Joellen Prasad. She's an inclusion and moderate disabilities physics teacher at Madison Park Technical Vocational High School in Boston. Welcome to Radio Boston. Joellen, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We just heard from Becky there in Newton. She's a middle school teacher, and she has some concerns. What are your concerns?
Yeah, you know, as a moderate disabilities teacher myself, I am always thinking about how am I providing these accommodations to my students and how they may not be getting that what they need in entirety. And she mentioned the hybrid model. And what people do not know is that, yes, during those times that they are not, when they are engaged in asynchronous learning, basically they said to curb the amount of hours, we shouldn't really be engaging with them. Like, I can tell you every teacher is not going to do that. We're going to end up doing the extra work to make sure those students are getting what they need. But the truth is, yes, you're only getting half of the time, whereas even though we are remote, I am with you all of the time. I am able to see you. I am able to have conversations with you. You can see my assets, right? Versus 2 days on and then 2 days off, 3 days off, actually. I think that we need to really be thinking about how really the remote learning, although difficult, does allow for more interaction and more assistance and more accommodation than this hybrid model.
And so then what is your response to Commissioner Riley, who really is pushing for getting students back in person?
I mean, first and foremost, I want to be very clear, teachers want to be with our students desperately. We agree that almost unanimously, I would say, that this way of teaching, of being together, is what we want to be doing. However, we need to be thinking about their health, not just their health, but also the community's health, who they go back to, thinking about transportation. And we need to remember that the Association of Pediatricians, she said that we really needed to have focus on reopening schools in a way that maximizes safety, learning, and the well-being of children, and it would require new investments. And we did not invest in a way that would allow us to reopen in an equitable and safe way. So yes, I agree, we all want to be there, but unfortunately we didn't put in the work necessary to make it so it's safe and equitable.
So, Joellen, finally, what's your message to your students, to the parents, to the folks who are calling in, who are just as frustrated perhaps as you are?
I would say that we need to make sure that we are making our voice heard, that we are saying, let's not have a one-size-fits-all approach when we're thinking about people speaking about elementary versus middle versus high school. Let's think about them individually, and know that teachers truly do want to do our best work, and we just need the support of the district, because this is a lot of work and we have not been given a full plan, so we can't be expected to have a perfect plan. So let's all be patient with one another, but also make it very clear what our desires are, and that health and safety are at the forefront in tandem, and they are tantamount to education.
Joellen Prasad is a teacher at Madison Park Technical Vocational High School in Boston. Joellen, thank you.
Thank you.
And WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, if I still have you, just to wrap up here, we've heard a lot, and we have a number of callers who unfortunately we're out of time and won't get to, including someone who's noting that, you know, this study about students and children being less susceptible to coronavirus is perhaps one study, and there's a lot we don't know about the virus. But Max, in hearing all of our guests today, our callers, how are you thinking about where we're headed in the fall?
Yeah, Jamie, I think you hear some resignation, particularly as Carrie Norman speaks, that none of this feels good. We all would have hoped that we were past this by now. The virus was sort of totally under control in the United States, but that's not the situation. And then, you know, I can't help but look at the example of Israel, where schools reopened, it appeared they had the virus under control, and then schools became a vector. I think that's something we should all be trying to avoid you know, pretty ardently, even as we rush to serve the educational, social, and emotional needs of students, you know, in the interim while we wait for a happier time.
Yeah, that seems to be the message here of 2020 while we wait for a happier time. WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, thank you so much, Max.
Thank you, Jamie.
As America's reckoning with racial injustice continues after the killing of George Floyd at the hands of police, Black people across the country and the Commonwealth are coming forward with their stories of racism. Among them are sisters Emily and Caroline Joyner, who wrote about their experiences growing up in predominantly white Southboro. They want to challenge small towns like Southboro to acknowledge and confront local issues with race. WBUR's Kyrie Thompson spoke with the two sisters and brings us this report.
Caroline and Emily Joyner say they're not activists or experts on combating systemic racism, but they do know what it's like to grow up Black in a place like Southboro, a town that's over 80% white and less than 2% Black, according to recent U.S. Census estimates.
I tried to mute my Blackness in a lot of ways just to sort of get by as a way of survival, and that's something that I'm sort of getting closer to understanding that and sort of unlearning.
That's Caroline, who's now 27 years old and is a performing arts publicist in Brooklyn. Emily is 2 years older and is working on a doctorate in psychology at Boston College.
That white-centered perspective can get so internalized as a Black person who grows up there. It's like you learn, yeah, right, I'm other.
The sisters are biracial, but Caroline says their lighter skin tones didn't shield them from white high school classmates using racial slurs around them and mocking their natural hairstyles, while also appropriating Black culture.
I remember kids being like, do you know how to like teach me how to Dougie, like dance moves? And I was like, I don't know. I've grown up in the same environment as you. Or this one girl was just like, Black power, Caroline, am I right? Or something like that, where I was like, wait, what?
And Emily says the environment in the classroom wasn't much better, as teachers avoided broader conversations about race.
Seeing Black culture commodified and held up while also feeling like my own Blackness was shameful, different, and embarrassing, and don't bring it up because it's rude. It was just such a lot of contradictions to hold.
The Joyners are processing these memories again after the killings of George Floyd and other Black people by police. For the sisters, the police shooting of Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta especially hits home.
One of the two Atlanta police officers involved in the deadly shooting of a Black man in a Wendy's parking lot is a Massachusetts native. Devin Brosnan grew up in Southboro. He was not the shooter in the high-profile death, but he has been placed on administrative leave.
Emily and Caroline say they rode the school bus with Brosnan as kids. 3 years ago, another of their old schoolmates, Matt Colligan, was spotted marching at the Unite the Right rally alongside white supremacists in Charlottesville. Caroline says she sees a connection between these two incidents and the unconscious racism she and her sister experienced growing up.
It was more just like not to just personalize it around these two people and individualize the racism. It was like, oh, of course they're a product of towns like this. It wasn't surprising to us.
The Joyner stories resonate with me because I lived them myself as a biracial Black boy in the white suburbs of Hobart, Indiana. I still remember the humiliation of being called the N-word when I was 8 years old, and the terror I felt at age 17 when a Hobart police officer put his hand on his gun as he approached me in my own driveway one night. And Emily says people from Southboro took notice after the sisters wrote a blog post about their childhoods.
White people I grew up with, you know, send me messages like, oh my gosh, your article really woke me up. It was such a gut punch.
But Caroline says they aren't speaking out now to help people achieve some personal racial enlightenment. They want to target the systemic racism at the root of the problem.
In order to dismantle that, you have to realize how you've been benefiting off this system and then actively try to dismantle it. Not just peace and love, like unity. What is my place in this? And what am I doing to challenge it?
The Joyners say Southboro isn't the only place in need of soul searching about race. They say it's time for every community to think about how they perpetuate those systems and unlearn them, just as we've had to.
That report from WBUR's Kyrie Thompson. So, for me, It's those little salty pretzel nuggets. You know, the ones with the soft peanut butter core. They literally come in a bucket, and it makes the mindless shoveling of sugar, salt, and carbs just so easy. And I'm sure we all have our own food weaknesses, especially during such a stressful time as the pandemic. And the data bears it out. In the first few weeks following the shutdowns, packaged food sales spiked anywhere from 30 to 60%. But while the stress of the pandemic might have us turning to junk food, new research is showing a strong connection between what we eat and our mental health. Dr. Uma Naidu writes about the ways in which we can help our own mental health by changing what we eat. She's a professional chef, the director of nutritional and lifestyle psychiatry at Mass General Hospital, and the author of a new book, This Is Your Food, This Is Your Brain on Food. Dr. Naidu, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And listeners, we want to invite you to the kitchen table here, so to speak. What foods have you been gravitating toward during these stressful times? What foods do you find yourself eating that you just didn't eat before the pandemic or only had once in a while and now you can't stop shoveling, say? How have you stayed mentally and physically healthy? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, so Dr. Naidu, I want to start with just this simple question, which is, how are you holding up in this pandemic?
Given that we are launching my first book during the pandemic, I myself have had some stressful times, so I certainly understand how people are feeling. And when I speak to my patients, I mean, I think some people are doing worse than others. So it's been an unusual time for many. So, including myself.
Yeah. So I know this is your area of expertise, but do you have a food weakness like those salty peanut butter pretzels that I've been going to?
Yeah. So it's not necessarily pretzel to me, but it's usually some kind of salty cracker, or salty snack, just because I like that crunch factor. And, you know, so I've learned to make some oven roasted kale chips and been practicing some recipes with healthier veggies in the air fryer oven. You know, so zucchini fries are a good one because they're so low calorie. And when you don't deep fry them, but use an air fryer oven, you can get a really, really delicious taste and kind of replace that crunch factor that you're looking for.
So, Dr. Naidu, I hear you, but my brain is saying one thing, my stomach is saying another thing, right? Like,
I
hear you saying kale chips, but my stomach is like, I don't want kale chips, I want the pretzels. So what is the science behind that?
So it's interesting, you know, because when we're stressed, our brain becomes hypersensitive to the rewards of tasty, high-fat and high-sugar foods. And it gets reinforced. So we feel, you know, we feel a certain upliftment and we feel good when we eat those things. The problem is, over the long term, they do impact our brain. The second thing is that because of how these stress circuits work, some studies have also shown that, you know, the way that the reward system through sugar works in the brain is very similar to the reward system of how cocaine works. So there is this reward cycle that gets set up, and we have to sort of step back from it and figure out, look, it's great to have a treat once in a while, but if we eat that all of the time, it is going to add up, because when we eat these sort of processed, you know, whether it's high fat or high salt or foods that have artificial dye stabilizers and things like that, they aren't good for our brain. They may just make us feel good in the short term, but ultimately studies have even showed that the high sugar levels that get caused when we have a spike in our blood sugar lead to problems in the brain, such as even atrophy and dementia over time.
Well, on that maybe sad note, I do want to bring in a caller here. We have George. He's calling from I-95. George, what have you been turning to during the pandemic?
Oh, man, that's scary to hear, because every week throughout the pandemic,
George,
Brendan and I.
Unfortunately, we really can't hear you there. Maybe if we can get you on a better line there. But I think the point George was going to make was that they, you know, he's been turning to ice cream, and that's totally understandable, right? I guess my question coming out of George there is there a problem with from time to time turning to these comfort foods, as I'll call them?
Absolutely. So I the way that I work with in my sort of nutritional psychiatry treatment plan, I feel that people should have a treat day every week. And I don't call it a cheat day because psychologically, you know, you feel badly if you think you're cheating on something. So call it a treat day. So whether for you it's the salty pretzels or for George it's ice cream, enjoy it on that day. Appropriate portion control, you know, so not the whole tub. Enjoy it. And then at the next meal, the next morning or whatever it might be for you, you know, continue a healthier diet. That way you don't feel deprived. Maybe if someone's eating ice cream every night, they need to cut back to a few days, and over time, just try to replace that with, you know, a healthy recipe that almost tricks your brain into feeling it's getting that sweet taste, but with healthier ingredients. You know, there are certain ice creams that you can make, you know, from fruit. Mm-hmm. And certain fruit definitely have a higher glycemic index than others. So again, this is not an every night treat, but it's still something. I made a delicious chocolate mousse the other day using very ripe bananas, super dark cacao, which is actually good for your brain because of the flavonoids, and a natural cocoa powder. And I added a little bit of avocado in it. And the creaminess, if you tasted it without me telling you what was in it, you would have thought you were having a dark chocolate mousse.
Sounds
so
delicious.
I think, you know, exactly. It's almost like I do think that we have to find ways to replace those delicious foods and not feel deprived.
I just want to throw the number out here again, 1-800-423-8255. What foods have you been turning to during the pandemic? How have you been coping? Do you have any food, nutritional, mental health questions here for Dr. Naidu? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. We have another George calling from Lawrence. George, what have you been turning to?
I've been drinking a smoothie made of avocado. Believe it or not, it doesn't taste avocado. We provide us...
So what else do you put in it?
I half of a lemon, half an avocado, and two different kind of milk, together with a little bit of sugar. I don't use sugar in particular, but some people suggest to put some sugar. The result has been fantastic.
Great. Thanks for the call, George. Dr. Naidu, how about that? How about, you know, fruit smoothies, avocado smoothies, but then also maybe a little sugar? Or do you have sugar substitute ideas that folks can
try? Exactly. So, you know, I think that George is onto a healthier option. I would give some suggestions about that. You know, rather than actually, you know, just using pure cane sugar, I would suggest maybe using a small drizzle of honey in to sweeten. I would also recommend about a quarter piece of a medium avocado a day, which is the portion of sort of the healthy fat from avocado that you want. You can add creaminess by putting a little bit of almond butter, which, you know, brings you back some protein and creaminess and a great flavor, and also sweetness. So the one thing I would say is try to get rid of the sugar in that and replace it with a different way to sweeten it. But otherwise, I think he's doing well. Berries are a good choice. You can throw in some greens there as well, because that gives you some great veggies, which give you natural fiber for your gut, also important.
So you write in your book about this connection between the gut and the brain, this sort of important line of communication or microbiome. Can you explain the new research that you're finding out about that connection?
Sure. Sure. You know, the microbiome has been studied for a very long time, but over I would say the last few decades, we're understanding a little bit more about the connection between the gut and the brain in relation to mental health. And even though in the body they anatomically not close by, they are connected by the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is something I like to call the bidirectional superhighway, which connects the gut to the brain. And it also means that this communication, think about it as a mass pike in your body, you know, and it's pretty much traveling and it's fast all
for
the time.
For me, it's definitely a mass pike for sure.
and then another thing people need to understand is there is, number one, a connection. Number two, serotonin is known as the happy hormone, and more than 90% of serotonin receptors are in the gut. So that should help people understand that when you eat something, you might immediately, or over time, I should say, have an impact on how you feel. So there are several reasons for that. And then the actual microbiome is made up of at least 39 trillion bacteria that live there. And our goal is to, on most most times and most meals to try to grow and support the healthy bugs and not the unhealthy ones. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that the unhealthy bugs love processed foods, sugar, salty snacks, and all the stuff that's bad for us. And when they start to thrive, over time is when we start to set up inflammation in the body. And you hear conditions like leaky gut and other things like that. Well, another component of that is people present with mental health symptoms as well. Depression, anxiety, etc.
So, and what about the effect of so many of these substitute products that you see out there, Splenda or aspartame, or just the artificialness of all of that? You write about that in the book, but tell us what that does to the brain and for your mental health.
Exactly. So many of them are super sweet, and they are gut. Most of them are gut disruptors. The two that are healthier than others. So if you're really struggling with sugar and you're trying to embrace a healthier lifestyle and move, nothing can be done overnight, but move towards healthier options, you might want to consider small amounts of stevia or erythritol. If you say have 6 sugars in your coffee in the morning and you want to start cutting back, those might be good ways to start. But in general, the sweeteners have a pretty high profile of being gut disruptors, and they're by disrupting the gut, meaning that they change that imbalance and they start to create a problem. In that way and others that we describe in the book, it's just easier to avoid them for your mental health, because I know that in anxiety, for example, they actually worsen anxiety.
So Kellen is calling from Ashburnham. Kellen, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I actually work as a registered dietitian, and I'm very passionate about eating disorder recovery. And by listening, I'm wondering if I could hear some thoughts on maybe if it's worthwhile to put some more nuance into the conversation and think about people's relationship with food and how it might be affected by all of this talk about sugar and replacing things like chips with kale chips, because fundamentally they're two very different things, kind of, as you noted. So right. I'm just really curious to hear her thoughts about that. I'll take my answer off to you.
Thanks, Kellen. I was having a little bit of trouble hearing you, but I think you said you're a registered dietitian. How about that, Dr. Naidu?
So I didn't actually hear some of the question. I'm sorry. Could you repeat it for me?
So sure. She's calling for some nuance, for folks who might have eating disorders in thinking about replacing foods and
sure.
what they're eating.
I think that's a great question, Kellen. We thank you for calling in. I would say that, with eating disorders, as a psychiatrist and having practiced for a few decades now, they are a particularly difficult diagnosis to treat and very important to offer well-rounded care. So, my approach is always sort of in holistic mind-body approach that is integrated and functional. And in terms of that, what I mean is I always look for root cause. With eating disorders, it may be more complicated than just about what someone is eating and when they're eating it. There are often deep psychological factors that go on and something that we need to understand. So, there are components of different types of talking therapy that are involved. Sometimes it's a program that needs to be involved so the individual can really be helped to ease from the more difficult behaviors that they are struggling with to a healthier way to embrace food. Their relationship with food, in other words, is much more complicated than, saying, you would like a salty snack, have kale chips instead. I agree with that. It's much more complicated and nuanced, and we have to have the conversation with an individual patient to understand where they're at, what sort of help they need, and it might be that they need much more than just a conversation around the food. Because in my experience in working with eating disordered individuals, it is much deeper than that. I would fully agree with that.
So we are, the clock is ticking down here, so I do want to get to a couple of other things here. I was struck in your book by your support of a Mediterranean-style food plan. Yeah, mm-hmm. I could just hear my dad yelling in my ear, you gotta eat fresh vegetables, whole grains, fresh fruit, and olive oil on everything. But why does this right. style of eating again and again prove so healthy?
Absolutely. So there's a good amount of research data that the Mediterranean eating pattern, Mediterranean diet, actually has been shown to improve mood disorders. So I think that is one really good data point for us to know and understand. The other is that many of those things that, we hear doctors and dietitians and nutritionists talk about, like myself, there's a greater meaning to it. Feeding our the bugs in our gut with the right types of food helps them thrive. Mm. And you can only get fiber from fruit, vegetables, beans, nuts, seeds, legumes, and healthy whole grains. You cannot get it from seafood protein, no matter how healthy it is, or lean meats. So when we say that, one of the very important reasons in mental health is that it's feeding fiber to the bugs, and the fiber helps them produce the healthier substances that really help balance our mood, help our gut function properly, and actually fend off inflammation, which is the basis of many different diseases. So, you know, there are other factors such as olive oil having anti-inflammatory and antioxidant effects. You can have, you know, a good source of protein from beans, nuts, legumes, and seeds. There is additional fiber in some of those and other nutrients. So that's really the impetus behind that diet. And then it's been proven to help mood. So I think it's, you know, it's an easy way to go and while still having your treat day.
Yeah. And I'm also reminded that you wrote about the power of blueberries and PTSD. And I'm just wondering, yes. You know, what other foods would you suggest that actively support good mental health?
Absolutely. So things that are antioxidant and anti-inflammatory support good mental health. Some things that one should think about, which are unusual and you may not yet be including in your diet, and some people may, are things like the spiced turmeric with a pinch of black pepper. There are several randomized controlled trials that have shown an improvement in depression and a lowering of anxiety, as well as other symptoms, because of the powerful antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and other effects. If it's not something you're cook with, added to a soup or a smoothie.
How would you use it? I mean, who doesn't use it regularly?
Sure. So a quarter teaspoon with a pinch of black pepper, you can put it into a smoothie. I promise you won't even taste it. And the reason to add black pepper is it makes the curcumin and turmeric bioactive, which makes it more helpful to your brain. Secondly, you could use it in a stir fry if you do cook with it. But some other things that you could add are just foods rich in prebiotic fiber and probiotics. Probiotics are things like yogurt with active cultures or fermented foods, kefir. And I suggest yogurts or kefir, I always say the unfruited kind because the added sugars just don't do us any good. Buy the plain style yogurt and add berries or cinnamon to make it sweet for you.
Just because I'm aware that the clock is ticking by. And so in our just final 30 seconds here, Dr. Naidu, perhaps to folks listening who are feeling anxious, feeling worried, hearing all of these suggestions and maybe even that is giving them a little bit of anxiety. Just what's your one sentence tip for folks?
Sure. Include omega-3 foods such as salmon, fatty fish, and salmon, and include spices like turmeric with a pinch of black pepper, and avoid sugar, processed vegetable oils, and artificial sweeteners. That will start you off on a good path.
That sounds great. Dr. Uma Naidu, she's a professional chef, the director of nutritional and lifestyle psychiatry at Mass General, and she's the author of the new book, This Is Your Brain on Food. Dr. Naidu, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.